From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 9th day of August 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jackie Vay. She's at Stuart Peterson. Scott Irwin from the U of I will be here to explain how USDA compiles and calculates tomorrow's August crop production report, other crop production reports as well. I'll take you back to Monday and Secretary Perdue's visit to the state and what I believe were some of the farm policy issues he laid out during his travels. And as we wrap up our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast, too. That with Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, it's a Wednesday afternoon. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media, public radio for the farming world. Tomorrow, the United States Department of Agriculture at 11 o'clock will update the crop production figures for corn and soybeans. And when I say update, it's the first one of the year. So this is the first real yield projection that USDA NASS has made. That also will translate into its World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates reports. Joining us now to talk about these numbers and some of the expectations is Jackie Vink. She's from Stuart Peterson. Thanks, Jackie, for being with us. Tell me what you've been looking at as it refers to these reports.
Well, I looked at a lot. I mean, there's really nothing to talk about in the markets today because, you know, they're typical pre-report day posturing and hardly any movement in most cases. When it comes to the August USDA report, I think it's interesting. It ranks number one most volatile report for corn and number two for beans. So you can tell, and like you had just said, you know, this is the first real time that we've got them out in the fields actually looking. Now, on the day of the report, on average, corn's been up 8 or down 11. And 2 weeks after, it's been up a whopping 1 or down a third. really exciting 2 weeks later, isn't it? On beans, on the day of the report, up 19 or down 14. 2 weeks later, up 1 or down 1.5. So, you know, you can tell the excitement is gone, and now they're on to the next report. This report is made up of what they call objective numbers. Objective means where the USDA actually goes into fields in major states, you know, produce 75% of the grain. So for corn, they're going to look at plant population and ears per acre. And for beans, they count pods with beans in them in an 18-square-foot area. The subjective part of this report is the surveys they actually do with farmers. Now, last year, they did 22,100 farmers, and they're done either by telephone, email, or an actual hard copy. So it's going to be interesting to see if everybody... If all the pundits' dreams come true tomorrow, we just don't know. But I can tell you that on August 16th last year, on the crop progress report, 96% of the corn was soaking or beyond, and 55% of the beans were potting or beyond. This Monday, when we had the 8-7 crop progress, now they surveyed right, I think, up until last week, Friday. 93% of the corn was soaking, and beyond the five-year average is 94. So we were only really a percentage behind. And 65% of the beans were potting and beyond, and the average is only 62. So we were actually ahead on beans. Two of the big major things that can happen on this report, number one, we usually see a yield adjustment unless the growing season's been very steady and things haven't changed much. They do have the right to change acreage. And they can do that only if the spring planted grain conditions are thought to have altered planted acres since the June acreage report. We go back to the subjective part of the, when they're talking to the farmers, they're asking the farmer, what do you think your crop is going to produce? And so it's a collaboration between the farmer and the USDA to try and give us a closer picture of basically what's happening out in the fields.
And they also include the FSA numbers as updated as they have, and they get them in real time, so they'll be updated tomorrow morning.
Right.
As reported by producers as well.
Yes, and I'm actually very proud of that because I went to the USDA and recommended that. I was the only person in the room. I raised my hand. I think there were 100 and some of us, and I just said, you know, it seems so funny to me that you would do it any way different than that. Before, you know, they always released it the week after the report, and it was just a wild and crazy mess. And so I was very happy that they agreed with that and finally put it into action. The other thing, you know, we're going to see now, here's some guesses. You talked about the guesses that we're looking at. Corn production, the average guess is 13.841 billion bushels. Now, that is down from 14.255 on the July report. Soybeans, 4.2 and 4.202 compared to 4.260. So, again, an expectation on both sides that we're going to go down. Corn yield, 166 compared to 170.7 on the last report. Beans, 47.4 compared to 48. World production, not a lot of change. You looked at the corn, 227 million metric tons compared to 227.5. Beans, 94.4 versus 94.8. Wheat, virtually unchanged. And when you go to the 17-18 crop, basically a slight drop in the corn. In the beans, also a drop. And on wheat, also a drop. So I thought that that was pretty interesting. You know, some of that is coming because they're expecting that, the changes are going to be made at the yield level. Nobody, when you go out there and look, is really talking about changes coming out, you know, when it comes to the actual acreage. So I did an example. You know, what might the markets do? Well, the first thing I want people to think about is where the managed money is actually at. And the estimate as of this morning was that they were net long 95,000 corn, 39,000 beans, short 11,000 meal, and long 70,000 soy oil. So what that virtually says is, you know, if this is a positive report, we could see, you know, we could see them add. If it's a negative report, this is the first place things will move, you know, and you'll see them try to take profits back home if they've got profits. So here's the example that I wanted to use. The average corn guess is 166 bushels to the acre. And I'm going to say, because there, you know, anybody you listen to that's talking out there is saying that we're going to lose some corn acres, that they're way over the top on corn. So I took away the 900,000 they just added on the last report and went to 90 million compared to 90.9 million, which gives us a drop of 400 million bushels, and that's using 83.5% harvested area. Well, guess what? You know, the average guess is that we're going to have a carryout of 2.003. This comes in at 1.925. I don't think either of those is something so supportive that it can necessarily blow us to the upside resistance on December at 388. I could potentially take out support at 375, but more than likely it would go down and probably test support, you know, rather than taking it out. When you look at the beans, the lower yield at 47.4, you know, they've been saying that there's not enough acres, so I kicked in 500,000. I mean, these are just examples to give everybody an idea of what might happen. That's up 500,000 acres. So that would give us an increase of 53.5 million bushels of beans using 99.1 for harvested. And that bumps the bean carryout up to 514. And the average guess right now is 424. I don't think 514 is probably necessarily in the cards. We've really been burning through the beans, but it's hard to say. November's upside resistance, 984, supports at 955. So, you know, it's going to be, you can see why it could be a really volatile report. Anybody who's out there that's sitting on a lot of unpriced crop should really be thinking about it just in case we do end up with those types of numbers. I think a lot of people think that, you know, well, you kick off a million acres and you're basically, you know, you're just adding reducing the carryout by 166 bushels to the acre. They don't think about the 83.5% harvested, and that can nip you a lot of times, you know. So I just think they need to be prepared. That's all. Can't wait till see 11 o'clock tomorrow.
Indeed. Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate you taking the time with us.
Thank you, Ted.
Jackie Vex is with Stuart Peterson. You know, earlier this week I chased, and let me be perfectly clear here, I was not riding with Secretary Perdue, but chasing him from one venue to the next. And frankly, I arrived a bit late in Chenoa, where he spoke at the Evergreen FS, and I missed the press gaggle there, so I really don't have a handle on how the Secretary thinks about nutrient loss or fertilizer movement off the field. I'll take some time and listen back to his comments from the other two venues, because it may very well be that he addressed it. Still, here are some of the defining policy items I did hear from the Secretary. Let's start with CRP, or the Conservation Reserve Program. He's not a fan of expanding it.
I don't think expanding CRP is the answer. I think we really need to look at it in more fragile land, take that unproductive land out of production, the fragile land, the environmentally sensitive land, and let's do more of that. Let's target CRP rather than taking wide swaths out. Today, as a congressman can tell you, we've also heard some issues with CRP outbidding young farmers, and that's a challenge. When the government gets in the way of the market and farmers can get a higher rate of return from the government than they can from the rental rate, that's keeping our young and beginning farmers out of the market. And we need to correct that as well.
So the administration is saying no to expansion of CRP, and they're making a connection to young and beginning farmers to support that no. On crop insurance, one of the compromises that has been clearly identified already is the possible elimination of the harvest price option. This allows farmers to buy up their insurance plans to pay out in the case prices are higher at harvest than at sign-up time. For Perdue, this isn't really a compromise. It's mostly, he thinks, just going away.
At some point, just like marketing a crop, you've got to pick and choose. I think I don't think we want a program where, you know, heads you win, tails you win. I think there needs to be a marketing decision that's provided there.
I need to be careful here because he did hedge, and that quote actually starts, and I was still asking the question when he began his answer. All of that may be in the mix of how we do our prices, and then he went on. Most assuredly, harvest price option is on the table. The question and answer session with the Illinois Farm Bureau serves to point that out as well. A member asked the secretary to make no changes to the crop insurance program. He pivoted in his answer to dairy and cotton. Roughly speaking, that may mean, sure, but we need money for these other farm sectors. And since the money pot isn't getting bigger, well, but he didn't exactly say that. The pivot was most assuredly there. He repeated a phrase a couple of times, we're going to do more with less. This came to roost when the state's livestock producers, the presidents of both the pork and beef associations, asked him to support $150 million to create a foot-and-mouth vaccine bank.
Just don't get hung up on $150 million. I'm gonna try to find the money, but you know we can do it with less, and $25 million a year or something like that. So I told you we're going to do more with less. But I understand that's a serious issue, and we're going to do everything we can to find the money.
Now, Perdue was asked about the nutrition program side of the Farm Bill, too. He didn't answer the question, but did stand firmly against decoupling it from the bill. There has been talk over the years of segregating farm policy from nutrition policy.
Well, we're not going to decouple that. I think the votes it takes to pass the Farm Bill are going to take urban votes that's very concerned about nutrition. But the fact of the matter is, the nutrition program serves as many rural citizens as it does urban. We got a lot of rural poverty out here and outside of the hinterlands and outside of the cities that need that program. We just want it to be a hand up, not a permanent lifestyle.
And finally, the one place the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture seemed to simply say, we need to do this, was as it pertains to basic applied research and science. However, the Trump administration's skinny budget certainly contradicted that statement. Factually, folks had to go to bat to support the USDA lab in Peoria and many other places around the nation. Thursday at 11 o'clock, the United States Department of Agriculture will release the first crop production report of the season for corn and soybeans. We're now joined by Scott Irwin, agricultural economist here on the U of I campus, to discuss just exactly how it is that the United States Department of Agriculture goes about gathering these particular reports. They differ a little bit from one month to the other, but mostly that's because of the available data. What happens for August?
Well, the first thing that I want people to make sure they understand that there's constant confusion about. The USDA basically starts yielding, releasing what people consider official forecast of corn and soybean yields, starting with the Ag Outlook Conference in February. We get a number. That's the USDA number. And that's essentially a trend forecast. It's taking the plot of yields, fitting a straight line to it, and projecting it. And with a few rare exceptions, they then stick with that in the WASDE balance sheets when they issue the first new crop balance sheet in May. They don't change it usually in June or July. So right now we have official USDA corn and soybean yield forecast of 170.7 for corn and 48 bushels per acre for beans. Those were in the last July WASDE. But again, those are based on very simple statistical analysis, and unless they get dramatic information, they don't change them. Now we get to August, and there's a clean slate. The USDA forecast in August is done by different agencies, completely different methodologies, and there's no connection between the two necessarily. So we're at 170.7 with the simple statistical method in July, and we could be at 161 or 165, 170, whatever it turns out to be on Thursday, but there's no connection. The USDA NAS agency doesn't start with that 170.7 number and adjust. That's the first thing that causes massive confusion.
Yeah, particularly that these are actually done by two different agencies. The World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, or the WASDE reports, are released by the World Agricultural Outlook Board, and they will take the USDA NAS numbers and massage them in some form sometimes. However, NAS is the one that develops the numbers for the United States, and they do it by counts and surveys.
That's right. And so and starting in August for corn and soybeans, from then August through January, the WASDE analysts are given the yield forecasts and acreage forecasts by the NAS folks. Those are the official forecasts, and they have to use them. So, okay, with that kind of as background, we're going to get a clean slate. Different agency, completely different methods. And there's a reason that the Thursday report is one of the biggest market movers of the year, because it's the first forecast coming out of a USDA agency that's based on, you know, there's a lot of resources expended to produce that estimate. And they do it with two different types of surveys. The first kind of survey, the NAS calls the Farm Operator Survey. Pretty straightforward. They have a huge list of basically all farm operations in the United States, and they know which ones produce corn from earlier surveys, and they basically use a computer-guided survey system, and they ask farmers, what do you think your yields will be this year in your fields? Very straightforward. And again, major source of confusion. When most people talk about the USDA estimates in August, they talk about the second survey, forgetting that there's this other survey that the USDA gives equal weight to, which is, what do farmers think about their yields? So we have the Farm Operator Survey, and you get a yield estimate from that survey. Then the USDA does their own measurements in what they call the speculative states. And there are 10 states in corn, and they go out and they take measurements in I think something around 1,500 to 2,000 fields in those 10 states. Very precise. They have trained enumerators that go out and basically do yield checks, just like lots of farmers and others are using very similar methods that most farmers are familiar with. You know, you measure off a section of the field and you count plants with ears. And if the ears are mature enough, you will, measure the number of rows. And
in the case of USDA, they simply measure the length of the ear.
The
and
length of
farmers
the ear.
Oftentimes will do rounds and
right. And then later in the season, they'll actually send a couple ears into a lab for weighing. But they don't do that until they're obviously mature. But the really important part is that when the USDA produces their official estimate, they have to look at the data from both surveys. You know, this is what farmers said. This is what the objective yield process indicates for a yield. What do they do? Well, Daryl Good and I had an article last summer on Farm Doc Daily called Opening Up the Black Box, where we really dug into recently released data to show what they do. And that's an interesting story in and of itself.
We'll go back and post that one into our website at willag.org so folks can find it. What'd you see?
Fascinating history of the nature of the data that USDA gets for this August survey. Basically, the objective yield measurements, where they go out in the field and take their measurements, they find that that is consistently high by a considerable margin. Not unusual nationally for that to be 10 or 15 bushels above where they finally come out. And guess what? What do they find out about farmers? Anybody who's grown up around farmers like I did, it's not surprising. They'll tend to be conservative. And they'll tend to be, in August, maybe 10 or 15 bushels too low. And there you have the secret sauce of the USDA estimates, what I call offsetting bias in these two survey numbers. And that's what gives them their accuracy. And you can say, oh my gosh, the USDA is using biased, inaccurate numbers. Statistically, it doesn't matter. As long as that bias is consistent from year to year, then you can produce accurate estimates by basically just taking an average of the two numbers and the biases offset. And, you know, in some years that works better than others. There's going to be some variability, but that's in essence how it works.
It'll be interesting to watch Thursday's numbers, because this one has been as interesting a growing season to this point as we've had for quite some time.
I agree completely. And this may well be the year that USDA and everybody else has a lot of problems getting a handle, particularly on corn yields, because we've had a really unusual weather pattern. So if you look at the averages on a monthly average basis here in the Corn Belt for temperature and precipitation, with a few exceptions, we're not that far off of average in most places. There certainly, again, are some exceptions. But those monthly averages can hide a lot of extremes, and some of those extremes might have been more damaging than we can simply pick up until we actually harvest the crop.
We may very well find the stresses when the combines run. Hey, thank you so much.
Always my pleasure.
That is Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the Urbana campus of the University of Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner is here. He's with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, let's start outside of the United States today. The wheat crop should be about to be established at some point fairly quickly in the Southern Hemisphere. Are there any concerns in particular with Australia?
Yes, Australia's had a very unusually dry winter season. They got off to a great planting environment last April and May in the southeast part of the country, but Western Australia never really got on board, and they've been struggling with dryness ever since. It's cool, so it's not a huge deal, but spring is right around the corner. August is usually the last of the cool months. We get into September, where it doesn't take long for reproduction to begin in northern crop areas. So it's very important that they get rain, and they got some in the last 24 hours, anywhere 1 to 2 inches in the southwest part of the production area in Western Australia, and about a quarter to maybe a half inch of moisture in the north. That's not a lot, but for them, that's gold, and they need more moisture, obviously, and it will come along this weekend into early next week. Western Australia produces 30 to 40% of their wheat, barley, and canola, so it's very, very big deal for them. Outside of that, the rest of the country's got some dryness issues that have evolved since the planting has occurred. There is opportunity for some relief, but some of the northeastern portions of the country, like Queensland and northern New South Wales, are still faced with some dryness.
From there, let's move back to the United States and talk about Illinois and Indiana in particular. There are dry areas and have been for some time in each of those states. Where are they and what do weather conditions look like today, maybe later in the month?
Yeah, you know, really Illinois is the state that probably is of most interest between those two. Indiana actually had some problems with being too wet for a while earlier in the year. Western and southern parts of Illinois have seen some rather restricted amounts of precipitation at times. And we got a little relief back last month, and that started to really get things going good again, but we have managed to stay relatively dry. So we're still carrying some large moisture deficits. If it hadn't been for all the coolness that we've had here in recent days, I think the situation would be much more serious than it is. Iowa is in much worse shape than either Illinois or Indiana. Iowa has a very large percentage of its crop country running short to very short on top and subsoil moisture. And if, again, it hadn't been for the cooler bias conditions here recently, those crops would have lost a considerably large amount of production potential over that which has already occurred because of the stress last month. But it has been cool, and we will stay that way. They've got a couple of opportunities for rain in both Iowa and Illinois coming up here in the near-term part of the forecasting is out into next week. But neither one of the events is going to be a big soaker. So it will warm up when we go into the second half of this month. So we're going to be watching both states very closely as we move out in time.
That's Drew Lerner. He's with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joins us on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Do listen to us anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our agricultural programming from the opening market report to the closing market report and everything in between, posted not long after it airs on our radio stations.